The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. Hello and welcome to The Extraordinary Ordinary, the podcast from Women of the Year, where we get to know the stories of remarkable women you've probably never heard of, but whose passion and hard work have changed lives, society, and even the world in all kinds of ways. I'm Mojo Abidi. I'm a journalist and the presenter of this very special podcast. And today I'm here with Imelda Paul. Imelda is a nun, but I can confidently say she's not quite like any nun you've ever met, because for the last 17 years, Imelda has been leading the fight against modern slavery in Albania. She co-founded Mary Ward Loreto, an organization which addresses the root causes of trafficking, rehabilitates victims, and brings the perpetrators of slavery to justice. She's also the president of RENATA, an international network of religious sisters who work together to combat human trafficking across 31 European countries. Of course, I wanted to know all about her extraordinary work, which has been recognized with a well-deserved MBE. But first, I was keen to find out what had taken her from her home in Birmingham to Albania in the first place. Imelda, welcome to the Extraordinary Ordinary podcast. It's great to have you here today.
It's lovely to be with you, Mojo, and I hope we can have a great conversation together.
Definitely. Now, fighting modern slavery isn't on the job description for most nuns, is it? I'd love to know how you went from becoming a nun to now tackling human trafficking in Albania. Can you talk us through that journey?
Yes, indeed. It was a very amazingly unusual journey for me because about 20 years ago, my congregation made a corporate decision to found a new community outside the boundaries of each province in the world. And I belong to the English province. And in that discernment process with my sisters in England, we engaged and invited CAFOD and CIIR and other international bodies to help us in our discernment. And finally, after a full year of deliberations, we chose from many other countries that came forward, Albania. And we went two or three times just to tread the water really there and to understand, was this the place where we were called to be? And in one of these visits, we had an interview with the then Archbishop of Tirana called Rocco Mirodita. And when we asked him the question, well, if we did come here, what would you think we would be called to do by the mission in this country? And he said, well, he said, there is the most terrible situation going on at the moment, that girls are being kidnapped, smuggled in speedboats from Albania across the Adriatic Sea into Italy. And there they're being sold off like flesh on a market and being used, abused as sex workers on the streets of Italy. A most terrible situation. And they were being thrown out after they were too sick to carry on this terrible constant rape on the streets. And also, they were also made pregnant through rape. So these girls were coming back and there weren't the resources back in Albania to really service and support these girls through their trauma and into newness of life. So he said, could you help? Would you work against human trafficking in this country? And from there, we said yes. And I got ongoing formation through Rhode Island University in America online, who did a diploma in human trafficking. And with that history and as a counsellor and teacher, we and myself and another sister stepped forward to do this work, invited by Caritas Albania to be part of their team to set up a shelter for trafficked victims.
That's so interesting. So that's how you ended up in Albania. But what about even earlier than that? Because during your career as a nun, you've been a teacher, worked in prisons, you've done all sorts of jobs.
Yes, I've been a nun for over 50 years now. So you can imagine the history is very colourful, really. I began as a teacher in our schools, Loreto schools, and obviously university and the postgrad and all that. And then sent to Scotland to a huge comprehensive to coordinate the development of new structures and teams and programs for teaching RE throughout this school. And from there, I was sent down to London, where I went to a Sink school, all boys, mostly migrants in the school. And from there, indeed, I did go visiting homes in King's Cross, all around King's Cross Station in London. And that led me also to prison work, in particular Wormwood Scrubs, where eventually I ran a little Bible group for prisoners. And in fact, the Birmingham Bombers were in my group, which was kind of amazing, beautiful people. And as we know, they were acquitted eventually, the Frank and Billy that were in my group. And from there, we realised there was a massive need for working with street children and young people in London. And that led to my working with Amari's brother called Ronnie McEwan. And together we set up a foundation called King's Corner for young people who were desiring to, for leadership skills and empowering skills. And it was really a wonderful experience. From there, I went up to Manchester, and there we had a preferential option for the poor as a congregation. And I was asked to go around England doing some social analysis in four parts of England, which was the Black Country, East Anglia, the North East, and the valleys where the coal mines had all closed. And there we were led as a congregation in England to found a community in the North East. And myself and another sister were asked to found that. And it was a beautiful experience after spending a year in my last final phase of formation in Africa, in Kenya. And those two experiences, in fact, especially my experience in Kenya, where I worked with the Kipsigis tribe out in Kibeneti. And out in Kibeneti, the tribe were the most marginalized in Kenya. And I learned to subsist for my life. We dug for food, we grew the food. It was mainly cabbage and ugali made from corn every day. We had to wait on the rains to dry the wood, to make the fires, to cook the food. We walked and walked one day to find a chicken because there were many, many people coming for a feast. And I can remember eventually finding an old hag of a bird that went totally in the pot and was extended to feed hundreds of people. It was like a miracle of the 5,000, you know? And all of this taught me and these young people in London to stop taking control of life, that life just unfolds. So I learned a lot about living on the edge, and that has been my main school of learning for working in Albania.
Wow, that's such a fascinating journey that eventually took you to Albania. Do you remember the first time you met a woman who'd been trafficked? What was that like?
I'd like to talk about the first two because they're very significant. The first one was the one that came as a referral through Caritas, and she already had a baby, and she was dysfunctional because her trauma had not been wholly addressed. And my working with her was very sad because she was showing that she hadn't got a capacity mentally to nurture her baby, and the baby was failing to thrive. And I remember at home weeping tears over the decision that we all had to come to help this person find her mental strength and let go of the baby for at least a time. And that was perhaps the hardest thing I've ever done, really, because I know how absolutely vital it is for a baby to be with her mother. So that was my very first. The second was very soon after that when I had to go up to the mountains to a clinic. It was a 5-hour journey through the mountains in the north of Albania. I'm slightly changing this story because of confidentiality, you can understand, Mojo. But this young person was introduced to me by one of the sisters working the clinic up there. And she was covered in sores from head to foot. She was the most beautiful girl, tall, elegant. She had been abused on the streets for sex work for 6 years before. She'd returned and managed to get rescued, but she'd come back in secret and so had gone back to her home without any care. And this young woman was in deep trauma that had led to physical skin complaint that was like blisters all over her body and sore and red. And this sister didn't quite know how to work with this young woman to get her healing. And so, together with my Caritas friends and support from a doctor in Turana, we managed to get an inventory of doctors that had some understanding of sex trafficking and trauma. And this girl was then referred to a doctor, and she's now married and she's living a very full life, as is the young girl. She has her baby, who's now a grown-up woman. So, there is an end to the trauma of trafficking, and not everybody finds new life, but a lot do. And we have to smile when we think of that too.
Wow, those are both incredible stories. Imelda, how do you actually go about fighting modern slavery? Because it's such a big and complex issue.
It's an almost impossible task, really, Mojo. But we do work together, not alone ever, in fighting human trafficking. My first attempts was very naive in Albania, and I could remember knocking on doors to get passports back for the first girls that I experienced coming from domestic labour trafficking, and they were not Albanian, they were internationals. They had come through illegal agencies from their country to us, where there was also illegal labour agencies. And these girls had been duped and had been given to rich family homes. And they had been not just used for domestic work and looking after the children, but working hours and hours, nearly the 24 they had, very little sleep, very poor conditions of their own living, sometimes sexually abused by the father of the house, a horrendous situation. And these first attempts of awareness raising and working against trafficking and combating human trafficking led me to realize, yes, their passports were taken from them. They were held with incredible power and abuse, often drugged into control, and fear, terrible fear arose. And so, how do you actually raise awareness about this or do preventative work? We have in Albania a wonderful NRM, National Referral Mechanism, which consists of Mary Ward Loretto, is part of that, and it's a government body, but also the directors of the shelters and also a couple of other NGOs. And as a team, we work together to make sure that survivors are all given the full process of the law, as well as full rehabilitation processes with medical, physical, and psychological healing, for vocational training through to employment, through to work in a bona fide way, and accommodation with possibly with the family. And the reconciliation with family in Albania is hard work, and that's also raising awareness, because a girl that has been sexually abused or even abused through domestic labour is given a stigma for future marriage. And it's very hard to get reconciliation. But this can be achieved, not with all, but with a few. So it's going step by step with the survivor, the victim, leading the way, absolutely at every step of the way towards reintegration into society. We do work in schools. In Mary Ward Loretto, we work in all the schools raising awareness. We work in communities in collaboration with local authorities, with local communities. We do service learning in schools, which is democratization of schools and enabling the older students to work with the local authority and indeed the governors of the school and local people to develop projects which will rehabilitate their own communities in villages and poorer parts of Albania. Lots of things.
So there are multiple branches to fighting modern slavery, from helping the victims to preventative work, bringing perpetrators to justice.
Oh, many things, and capacity building, advocacy, awareness raising. Is all part of the work, yes. And demand, facing the demand, confronting the demand. Cheap labor, cheap goods, cheap services are what people are looking for. And that's why trafficking is multiplying, because that's what they're servicing, the demand for cheap sex. the demand for sex online, all of these things is happening today by the traffickers who are getting filthy rich on the back of demand.
And is that the key driver for modern slavery? Is it always about money?
Always about money, yes. Whether it's to do with the trafficked who are vulnerable because of maybe natural disasters, war, poverty itself, or indeed through consumerism and a neoliberalism capitalist system that gives profit to the shareholders and very little to social need.
With the victims that you've worked with, would you talk us through how the human trafficking typically happens? Is it done by strangers or people they know? Are they groomed over a long period of time or sort of taken in the night?
There's many, many ways in which a trafficked person is trafficked by the trafficker. And there are three varieties of traffickers. There is the individual who may be a family member or a neighbour, and they sit close and watch, and they groom a young person for being trafficked, and they trust the trafficked person will trust the trafficker because they know them, and maybe they're even taken abroad, and part of the grooming is promise of a marriage, engagement, or work, and they trust and they go with, and they may be a whole year in this grooming process until they feel they're safe and life is good. They're getting opportunities, and then suddenly they're sold off to another who then brutally abuses them, and they might travel with them and are trafficked along the way, even across waters and by air. It's incredible how porous the borders can be when there is so much crime and fraud. And other ways are with groups, low-level groups of local people in a country who then maybe kidnap, smuggle. It might be the route of the migrant, and they pay a lot of money. The family puts money into the pot to get one of their members to bring back money to survive even the poverty. And along the way of the smuggler route, the transnational gangs might come on board. So you have small groups that are sold off to the transnational gangs, or even the small groups are in cahoots with, say, a small business in England who's a trafficker as well, maybe of drugs or of people, and they are in collaboration because they know them. There might even be family members in another country who have been successful, and the person is trafficked into business there. They get a job, they're doing very well, get a wage for a year or more, and then suddenly they're duped into working in criminal activity, and the traffickers are using them and abusing them in all sorts of ways, or selling them on into sex work, whatever.
Have you met many traffickers during your 17 years? What are they typically like?
Yes. No, I haven't met many. I have met some either in a prison or indeed you wouldn't believe this, but in a situation on the street in Albania where I was chatting with a guy and he admitted he was a trafficker, and we followed his journey through. It was horrendous. We have traffickers in prison, and we know that they sometimes have such a cold heart that they're not remorseful at all, and they might go back into the field when they come out because it's very much an easy buck. But we have worked with women traffickers, and some of them have really wanted to change their lives, and they have ongoing rehabilitation processes as we speak.
In the years that you've been working against trafficking, has it become more sophisticated with the internet and social media?
Oh, indeed. You wouldn't believe how much it's changed along the way. I mean, there's no more speedboats going from Albania to Italy, for instance, because there's a law against it. So that cannot be. So what is the alternative? And if we take COVID, my goodness, what has happened during the time of COVID has been so painful to see and watch and work against. And we had a training for our members of RENATA, which is Religious in Europe Networking Against Trafficking and Exploitation, which I work with very closely from Albania. But in that situation, we decided during COVID to have a training online for a week for all our members, and many of Mary Ward Loretto took part in this, in which we dealt with the issue of sex trafficking of children online during COVID, of which there was an explosion. And this was happening from an Asian country where the poverty, as COVID crashed, had become so terrible that children were starving. And so mothers, when approached by traffickers, in order to feed the other three children, were selling the young child of three, four, or five to the trafficker to be exploited with sexual exploitation online. And these children were live streamed and bought off by rich people in the West who were listening and seeing this horrendous sexual exploitation of little children in their offices online. And these traffickers were getting huge amounts of money selling the films over and over again.
That's heartbreaking and so difficult to even listen to. You've said that one of the key drivers of human trafficking is money. Did the issue get worse during the pandemic and in lockdown, as we know a lot of people struggled financially at that time?
Absolutely. And we do know that, in fact, in a most unusual situation, the law, and this is still so in some European countries that are not EU, but the law of data protection actually supports the perpetrator, in other words, the criminal who's buying this sex online, more than it is supporting the victim, the child, the young person. And we, with other international bodies that are working against trafficking, approached the EU corporately, signing documents to confront the EU about the weak law of data protection. And, I have to give my hand to the EU. Very, very quickly, within 3 weeks, they put in what they called a temporary law, and which actually protected the children. And children have been rescued from this work. They unfortunately can't go back immediately to the families, but they are being protected often by sisters' communities in these Asian countries, and they are working against human trafficking and are taking in the victims to give them all the care and help they need for rehabilitation processes.
Through things like the pandemic and with the development of modern technologies, are we seeing modern slavery being driven to the digital world?
I think pretty well everything that we work in is being transferred to the digital world to a certain extent. And we're not ready for this, either psychologically or even intelligently, really, in terms of our emotional intelligence and how that is being used in this trade, but also in terms of the very, very fast information that is being used to by the traffickers, very intelligent transnational gangs, and indeed more increasingly so intelligent individual and group trafficking bodies, because they're learning from the whole process how to become more wealthy. And money laundering by the traffickers is easier. People are being bought off to open bank accounts to launder the money. They're, as it were, arms to the traffickers to get the money transnational so that the traffickers are hiding the money. It's very, very complex, this digital crime that's going on, and the manner in which people are exploiting the finance world to become rich and greedy.
How difficult is it to traffic a person? Is it more difficult than, say, smuggling drugs?
They're saying now it's more lucrative. As for difficulty, it's probably easier to catch drug traffickers because of the dogs and the ways in which drugs can be sniffed out, if you like. And many drug traffickers are now becoming human traffickers as well, because it is easier at the moment to traffic human beings than drugs, and actually it is even more lucrative.
And as you've said, it always seems to come back to money. It just feels like money is just one of the key driving factors to a lot of these issues.
Indeed it is. And I think that the biggest way to prevent human trafficking is to completely transform the finance system of the world and to bring justice to those who are on the edge and to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor. And as Christina Lagarde said, she was the head of the IMF a few years back, and she said that unless we change the capitalist system to addressing the social need, then the whole world of finance will collapse, because it can't go on forever, this massive decline of the sensitivity to the needs of the poor and the absolute necessity to bridge the gap between those who have and those who have not. And I think Christine Lagarde, had she been listened to, we would be living in a different world today.
We've spoken a lot about how the traffickers are driven by money, but are the victims sometimes driven by money as well, seeking a better life? Are they often people from poorer backgrounds?
Indeed, it is always about survival for those who are trafficked, because they're on the other side of the gap. They are with the poor always. And also, this gap seems to be leading to great dysfunctionality in family life. And in Albania, we can put hand on heart and say, from our analysis of our victims that are in shelters and that are referred to our day centres as Mary Wardareto, that all come from dysfunctional families. So it's not just the poverty. The poverty can drive dysfunctionality. And also a patriarchal culture can lead to a great increase in domestic violence. And even in England, the first traffic victim I met from the UK in Rome was a girl from a middle-class family, but dysfunctional through huge, horrendous experience of domestic violence. So we're looking at multifaceted reasons for vulnerability.
That links in really nicely to my last question, because we've spoken a lot about many deep-rooted issues and injustice today. And you've talked about how the financial system needs a complete overhaul. But how do you think society needs to change so we can start fixing some of these issues?
I think that society through COVID is changing. I think there's something happening in our world today as it begins to be more broken that's getting many to wake up to what they really want from life and what really gives them energy and a feeling of peace and freedom and a sense of living the truth and the real. Because outside of that, we're all wearing masks and we're pretending we're happy. So it's like breaking down our own personal barriers first that disenable us from being who we really are and our deepest potential, that is the dream which was in the eye of God, you might say, when we were born. And to realizing that by together facing the issues that are breaking down our local environment and our suburban environment to our national to international world, which is collapsing really around us.
Melda, it's been so fascinating talking to you. I feel like I've learned so much, and your work in Albania just sounds so incredible. Before we say goodbye, I am going to ask you our four quickfire questions that I'll be asking all of our podcast guests. Is that okay?
Yes, of course.
Can you name a woman who's inspired you?
Yes, I have no problem with thinking about this, because it will be Mary Ward, who was a Yorkshire woman born 400 plus years ago. And she's my icon because she was so incredibly true to the real. Her charism is based on freedom, justice and truth, and also the liberation of women. Now, that was 400 years ago, and she said, there is no such difference between men and women, that women may not do great things. And I hope in God it will be seen that women in time to come will do much.
What an amazing message. What's one piece of advice you'd give your younger self?
My younger self, I would say, stay with the real, be faithful to the real and truthful to the real, and be such as you appear and appear such as you be.
What's the one thing you can't live without?
Silence, I think. Yes, I can't live without space to be, to reflect, to discern, and to pray. Meditate, I would say.
Tell me one thing about you that would surprise people.
I think people will be surprised that I'm the 10th of 12 children and that I have 34 nieces and nephews, and I have probably 60 grandnieces and nephews, and our family is immediately now and about 120 people.
You come from a huge family.
Yes, I do, and I'm very happy about this, and we are very close, and I love them all to bits.
That's lovely. I'm an only child, so we're complete opposites.
My mum was, so we understood that.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Amalda. I've really enjoyed having you on today.
It's been such a pleasure. I've enjoyed chatting with you. Really, I have. And thank you for the honour of being able to share all these thoughts and truths.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, please rate and review as it helps people to find us. To find out more about Women of the Year, go to www.womenoftheyear.co.uk. The Extraordinary Ordinary is brought to you in partnership with Silicon Valley Bank UK. They're the financial partner to the businesses, founders, and investors shaping the innovation economy. The bank for the driven, bold, unstoppable visionaries like you, using technology to make our world better. Learn more at svb.com/UK.